How would you know what proportion to stock them in a pond? You can't beat going to the literature.
Because, for instance, if you go to the Inland Fisheries Hatcheries in New South Wales, they'll tell you the ideal stocking rate, catfish to silver perch to what's known, after many, many trials, right? And I'll just give you a little package of fish in the right proportions. And your literature records lots of cases, for instance, for all the carps, it's been worked out for a long time, and the Israelis in particular gathered up and published the ideal mixtures in terms of numbers. They get along fine. As they all grow up, they all do their thing, and nothing eats anything, and you can almost count them out again. Otherwise, it is a matter of trials based on the literature of like species, so that you've got a sensible idea of how to start, like that quarter of them are predators, sort of, general, and that sort of thing.
Is there any extra figures that you can give us on flow?
Well, I'll tell you something about flow. It has an extraordinary effect on plant growth, in that up to a flow which is actually damaging, you know, sort of 10 metres a second or something like that, plants will grow five times faster per unit increase of flow. That is, if you shifted from 1 to 2 metre flow per minute or hour, you'll get a five times increase in plant production. So flow is extraordinarily beneficial for plant growth, and if your animals are depending on the plant growth in the water, then of course your animals benefit greatly from flow too. But here you've got another neat trade-off here. Your flow can be too great and can alter the nutritional base of your ponds. That is, you can actually lose nutrient rapidly. Typically, in a pond that you're going to raise the nutrient level, you close the flow right off, add nutrients, add your chicken manure, give it a couple of weeks with some little thing in it like shrimps, and then resume flow and then stock it. So you've got all cases covered. But if you're trying to add food to a trout pond with a high flow through, well, up to 40% of your food goes out downstream. Yeah, it's perfectly feasible to do so. Yeah. Yeah. Or maybe you can do something else. Maybe because you don't have any flow, you won't rely on plants in the water for a great product. You'll increase the margin of the pond and rely on land plants who flow doesn't affect in their growth, and stock fish that don't need high oxygen water. So just a different choice. You know, if you don't have flow, I wouldn't go for high oxygen fish. I'd go for a high value product like prawns, which are very dependent on the fringing vegetation for a lot of their food. So if we're sensible and choose our sites and then choose our species to suit the water quality in the site, we can get a successful aquaculture on. Because most people just go out to grow trout, and they'll go to the site, they'll buy a bit of cheap land on the side of a hill, and they'll do all the problems of forcing trout growth there. And that's where they lose their energy. That's where the energy becomes 30% of your cost, pumping your water up and down the hill. That situation. And that's not atypical. I mean, damn near every trout farmer I know took that option, went somewhere silly and started to grow trout. But the successful trout farms picked excellent sites and were out of trouble largely. Now, as far as another aspect of design, there's another one called anidation, which is a new word for you. I haven't been able to find it in many dictionaries. It comes from nidus, a nest, nesting within. And as soon as you think of it, you open up a whole new concept area. In fact, what happens when you choose an estuary to grow salmon in, and you put in the estuary big ring nets, and you grow this, and that's how they do grow salmon. So the pond is nested in a pond, you see, nesting within. So now when you think of the orders of ponds, you can nest orders of ponds within. Now say you've got a mask like this, and the thing is a foot deep, and you dig a hole in it, you have a pond nested in the marsh. What you've basically done, providing your hole isn't most of the marsh, is you've put a food, you've put an animal in its food. You've nested a trout in a almost uneatable food source. And you can put a fence here like this over the top and just go and forget it. And the growth is quite phenomenal. I did one. It beat anything else. I did a canal through a swamp and put trout in it and fenced it. And you can piss off. And 8 months later, you got a sort of 4-pound trout in there. Because there's millions of scuds swimming out of here and snails falling over the edge and shrimps and stuff. And your trout is nested within its food. Now, this is an ideal situation. Here, of course, your salmon is nested in the estuary where the tide is your current or your flow. And they do extremely well, and they get 60% of their food through the nets, right? Because the food, in a sense, is limitless out here. It's just the amount of movement bringing it through. So you can think of anidations. Now, there's some interesting potential anidations. For instance, this is new stuff. I've never tried this. I can only give it to you. In the sea, they've noticed where they've got methane bubbles coming up, there's a very rich life zone around the methane. However, the very opposite is true in a pond where the whole of the bottom is methane. That is, it's anaerobic. And a lot of ponds like that, a lot of swamps like that, you tread through them, it's just woof, you know, sulfur. So, but it's certainly true that anaerobic decomposition stimulates a lot of life forms. So why not nest a compost heap inside a pond? Why don't we compost underwater? Restricted methane production, so it doesn't make the whole pond anaerobic. And it seems to stimulate an awful lot of the small animals upon which fish feed. And then why not nest, you know, all sorts of nesting arrangements, you know. Why not have a small pond which is in partial conjunction with your large pond, because you can make this very hostile to fish but very friendly to scuds. You can load that with manure and just get bulk scuds breeding in it, or you can throw all your garden scraps in it and breed those little infusoria, and they come out in the millions out of those from lettuce leaves and cabbage leaves and that. And that's what you use to raise fish, and they're eaten by all plankton eaters. But no fish could live in there because they can't live in those anaerobic conditions. But the food will continually come out of there. So the whole question of anidation has been gone into quite a lot, and increasingly people are rafting fish in lakes, in raft situations. They're floating a net and the fish are living in the lake. And these are at present the highest production systems too, because a very high proportion of the food is grown in the is natural, and only a small proportion is fed to the fish. And they will make growth even without being fed, just that you've got to wait longer. So rafting systems. So that's a matter of having a large body of water where you can anidate, or having a swamp and so constructing your canals that all the swamp has a free interchange with your canal edges. So what can we put inside a pond? And then the whole question of rafting for waterfowl, you know. And we've noticed too that there's a lot of fish hanging below rafts. Quite a lot, and we're not quite sure what the total, whether it's shade or what it is.
So you can also hang brush from rafts and catch eggs and sport. It's done a lot. You can compost on top of rafts. And one of the really good thing to grow up there is slaters and earwigs and what do you call those little guys in town? Cockroaches. So you put a cockroach raft out there, and of course every time they run away they've had it. So you can produce a lot of food off a raft simply by putting waste materials, loading your raft with waste materials and returning it onto the water. And it all turns into slaters. I grow great slaters. I make a sandwich out of slaters. I put palings, seagrass, newspaper, palings, seagrass, newspaper, and she all turns into slaters, all except about 2 or 3% of it, of that mass turns into slaters, and I just build them in my chook yards. A friend of mine makes termiteries for his chooks. He sinks a 44-gallon drum like this, and he puts a few axe holes in it, and he fills it up with all the newspapers and bits of wood, covers it over, puts a little sprinkler and wets it down periodically, and just turns out bulk termites for his chooks out of these, and they run continuously. Another man called Dono Gorsic in Hawaii, he makes big cockroachariums. He makes big cockroach piles in his duck runs and just forks them over. He forks one over a week and sees murder. Cockroaches going everywhere, ducks going after him. The ducks just soon, they just see you with a fork. And you've got a crowd of ducks around you. So you can convert a lot of... And the other thing is grasshoppers. Now, if you've got a lot of grasshoppers, you should go into fish. And the way to go into fish with grasshoppers is to float yellow balloons, see? Here. Because grasshoppers got these terrible short-sighted eyes. And they think a large yellow balloon is a small flower, and they go for it. And if you... The real easy way, and of course they can't really make it to a big yellow balloon, it's too far away. So there's just a rain of grasshoppers falling towards yellow balloons. Yeah. Well, the way to test it out is to get a lot of colours on boards or plastic and throw them in the field and just go around and do your cockroach, or no, your grasshopper counts on your colours. Yellow's far the best. And it'll attract a hell of a lot of them. But not just grasshoppers. A whole lot of other little flies and things come to them too.
You've got this balloon on your pond.
Yeah. Well, you know, a 1,000 yellow ping pong balls or whatever, you know. As long as when a cockroach lands on it, he also gets in the water. Well, ping pong ball, he can't balance on that. So he's over. Little rafts of ping pong balls contained in little clear plastic rings are also very attractive to a lot of insects, you know. So you can might as well get these things into conversion. I mean, cockroaches are going to eat waste anyhow. You might as well have some eat the cockroach. That's the point. So all those are, and that's only part of them. I mean, you've got a light, lots of people's put lights over their ponds. Even in third world, you'll see about the only place you'll see lights burning all night is over the fish ponds, because that's all your pasture beetles come to those. They rain in on them some nights in Tasmania. You can fill 44-gallon drums with those little cut grub beetles. What do you call them? No, they've got a name.
Cutworm.
Yeah, cutworms, their larva. Yeah. Yeah. And then we've got the nocturnal flight of the armyworm moths. They cross Bass Strait in great swarms. So if you've got your lights up that night, you've got a lot of fish food there. So, you know, you can pull these things in just with lights or smells or whatever, you know, you can devise. Because there's a lot of food on the move. Some of it's going on past, migrating past. And you might as well convert it into what you want, whatever it is. Right. So all those are little
design ploys for your area, and they're worth limited trials. You know, try two yellow balloons and a small weak light, and then go on from there. But you can buy in the United States whole little systems where you have a little raft, I think it is, and you have a little solar panel and a battery and a light, and it runs a fan, and it's got an automatic switch, comes on at night, and these little moths come into this light, and this fan's going like a hell, so when they get anywhere near the light, bomp, they're down the water, you see. So you can buy those, they're standard fish pond equipment, and it pays you, if you're interested, to buy some of the professional aquaculture books from America, because they've got all sorts of kits of gear to add to ponds. Now, there's one other last thing about configuration. This is, I got it from an eel thing, but it applies to a lot of other things. If you have a largish pond which may suffer oxygen loss, and you've got a lot of valuable animals in it, you have to oxygenate the water. Now, that happens on two or three summer nights in the whole year, that your oxygen, in a weedy pond, that your oxygen levels fall very low. Now, there's automatic oxygen sensors are relatively cheap. They're about $30. And they'll switch on your oxygenator. So you have your sensors in here with a switch on. Now, what you oxygenate is only a very small portion of your pond. So if you're building a big pond, even a quarter acre pond, you should almost cut off one little section where you have your oxygen apparatus, because your energy costs of oxygenating 10 square metres is minor to have an air pump going in that section. And that's the section in which you normally feed your fish, so they all know their way there. And they know to go there when oxygen levels are low too. So instead of trying to oxygenate this pond, which is a dreadful job, the Japanese all try to do that, so do the Americans. They back up tractors and put big machines on and fans and that. Just cut it down and oxygenate a very small section of pond that'll hold all your fish. And it only takes a few hours, that is critical. So there's the other thing to do. In West Australia I would do it, particularly if you're going to grow weeds in your pond. I'd look to oxygenating one corner of it at an intensive production level. Intensive is more than 1,000 fish per hectare.
What's the principle behind the automatic oxygen sensing device?
Well, there's oxygen meters which you can buy. You can buy all sorts of automatic meters, temperature meters, oxygen meters, and they'll operate a switch for you. And that's just switches on your oxygenator, and when it falls down, they'll turn it off too. There are all standard things now for sale. You don't have to make them up. Anybody with any electronics can make them up.
That's why I asked what the principle
behind
the sensor was. If you don't know, it doesn't matter.
I don't see that. It doesn't matter what you're doing. pH, oxygen, temperature. It's just a meter which measured it and also activates a relay, that's all.
Yeah, well,
I see. Well, I can tell you where you can buy them. You can take it. I can also, some of them offer plans for them. Some people offer plans for them. Yeah, I don't know about the electronics involved, no.
How do you oxygenate it? With a sprinkler, or do you compress the air and put it in there?
Yeah, you compress air you just put an air pump on and bubble your air up from sunken pipes with about 1/8-inch holes. Seems to be ideal. And that's about it, I think. Now, we skipped pretty rapidly through aquaculture, but what I tried to do was to sort of do some principles. I didn't deal very much with specifics for you. On the other hand, you won't get a lecture on aquaculture that covers any more in a hurry. So any questions about it?
Where can we gather more information?
Right.
That particularly interests me. I'd like to learn a lot more.
Right. There's only two significant books on aquaculture. One's a classic. It's called Aquaculture. And it's by Bill McLarney and somebody else and somebody else. Huh? Bardak, McLarney and somebody else, isn't it? John. Yeah. Yeah. All of whom I know quite well. I suffered badly from Bardak. He's got a broken hip. He nearly killed me. Drives down the wrong side of the road, half blind. And then John Ryder and Bill McLarney, who's a member of New Alchemy. Now, that's kind of outdated, but it's a very good basic book, right? It's on fish, too. And it's not what you really want, but it helps. Now, there's one subsequent to that, which is fairly expensive, just by Bill McLarney, which is a much better book, more recent one, Aquaculture or Fish Farming or something. And that's pretty widely advertised now, and it's getting through here. You could order it. That's one of those authors. And that follows quite a lot of pond experiments. There's nothing really on plant cultures out yet at all. No, I don't know whether there will be. So you've got to chase that through the literature. If you want to grow taro, you've got to actually send to USDA or somewhere in Hawaii and get their recommendations on taro growing and so on. So really there's quite a lot of fish. And there's a whole really good series of stuff put out in a whole series of journals that deal purely with aquaculture, but it's solid stuff, you know. Been out for years, going for years, since at least the 40s. There's been a whole series of journals on aquaculture and fish raising.
Published here or
No, mainly published in the States, some published in England, some in Europe. So there's a whole journal literature.
Did you say that evidence of methane coming up in the sea
Right. And they found an extremely rich area for life forms, that they seem to cluster around it and do well, and there's a whole pyramid based on these methane emitters.
So
they're escaping from natural gas deposits.
I was going to say,
deposits.
Around natural gas areas, like in the northwest, where there's
there's a lot of gas bubbles under the ocean. There's probably a lot on land that we're just not visible.
Seaweed banks, you know, they get covered by sand.
Well, there's that too. And I imagine off the Ganges and that, by the time we've got a few thousand bodies and a few, and some mud flow, you've probably got a constant emission of methane on the continental shelf at the outfall of some of the large rivers too. But it seems to be a rich area. Not that the water isn't oxygenated, it's just that there's additional methane. And a lot of things that are... And also some of the sulphur volcanoes I've been discovering. There's a whole array of things on SO2. Well, when you compost in water, you get SO2 and methane. So it would seem to me to be worth a trial, water composting. Yeah, but that's different stuff. SO2 is naturally given off in all swamps. All digesters, you know. No, it's not. It's SO2 goes up, but sulfuric acid comes down. Yeah.
What about water purification? Is it feasible if you've got to recirculate your water to use plants to clean that?
They use very simple systems to clean up pond water. Basic things are slow sand filter, and if you're real finicky, they use charcoal. But a slow sand filter never cakes up. They go forever. You know how to build one? Oh, they run for centuries. I've had them in Britain in the sewage systems for yay, you know. You bring your water in at the base and have graded sand from very coarse material up to extremely fine sand on top. And you take your purified water out the top, and anything that was going to clog it up is destroyed down here and eaten up and disappears. I mean, hundredweights of organic material go up through there and never appears up here. Goes off as gases.
Does that clean up the ammonia and nitrites as well in the water?
It may do, but it's not excellent at that. The best thing for that is plants.
Yeah, that's what I'm getting at. Wouldn't it be better to use those nutrients rather than just to trap them?
Yes, that's another approach to it, that's sure. Yeah. If what you're doing is a fast recycling, maybe all you've got time to do is this sand filter, which has a lot of algae in it, right through the sand. It's very rich in algae up in here, very rich in bacteria down here. Well, but if you want to go on and use it, I'd put it through a bed of something like watercress, and then I'd put it back in the pond. I don't know, frankly, if we could. I think it might be more sensible to separate it, because the sand filter works well as it is. I don't know how it would go planted. You could try it. Might be good.
What sort of flow rates would you have through the reeds for the filtering?
What sort of what?
Flow rates on your water.
Right. Well, there's some good data on that in Kathy Seidel's paper. The Dutch use only reed beds to clean up their sewage, and they say, you know, a 10-day stay. So that's up to you. Whatever you, how much you're putting in, it should be 10 days. That's raw sewage. It should take 10 days to come out the other end, and then there's nothing in it. But you're not dealing with raw sewage, so you could look at something with a sort of a 2-day stay through a canal of reeds. It depends on what you're cleaning up. If you're cleaning up dieldrin or something, then you've got to have about a 20-day stay through rushes.
And what do you do with those
reeds
with the dioxin?
They break down chlorinated hydrocarbons, they break them all down. They break everything down. So it's in its hydrogen and carbon forms. You don't have to do anything with the reeds, they're okay. But if you're taking out heavy metals with some of the rushes, then you've got to harvest the rushes and put them to a no food use. And the best way to do that is put them through a destructive distillation, basically burn them, and then recover your metals. And if you get Hosseini's paper from Melbourne Metropolitan Water Board, she says that in sewage ponds, in your anaerobic pond, nearly all your heavy metals drop right out as insoluble sulphates. About 60 to 90% of all metals entering that pond never come out again. So that's in the sludge. So then you set up yourself a little mine in there, chromium mine, and zinc mine, cadmium mine. And that's been going 23 years and still taking out all the heavy metals. So,
what was the reference
here? Dr. Hosseini has written a paper available from the Melbourne Metropolitan Water Board on the removal of heavy metals in anaerobic sewage ponds. So again, it might be another very good reason to put water through an anaerobic digestion stage if it's polluted too, in that you've got that sulphur fixing potential for metals. Well, Leoflux aren't much of a problem. What seems to be the problem are worm eggs of some of the worms. They seem to come through most systems, and a couple of viruses. There are a couple of intractable things where you might need an ion exchange thing or something very small that these little ascaried worm eggs can't get through. There's two things seem to be a problem with dry toilets and natural cleaning systems. They're a problem everywhere. There's probably need to use UV or something if you've got that particular problem. Not everybody's got it. If you've got a population which is largely free of hookworm or something, or some viral diseases like hepatitis, then you're not really worried about it. A home situation or a fish pond situation, you're not worried about it because you haven't got it in the cycle anyhow. And if you're worried about it when you're returning the whole of the sewage water to a population to drink again, which we do all the time. I think we drink some of our rivers 9 times. I know that in between the head of some of the Victorian rivers and the sea, that same water is drunk and excreted 9 times. It goes in through the population, out through the toilets. So by the time you get down to Maryborough or somewhere, you've might be some little problems occurring. Yeah. Flukes are are the problem they're associated with snails, and you needn't have snails through the system. No need to. You can take them out any number of ways, and they don't come through sand filters, you know. So all that sand filter takes a lot of stuff out. It's very active, like there's a lot of things, eating things inside that sand filter. Yeah. But let's face it, where are you getting your water from now, you know? Partially purified reservoirs, highly chlorinated with 58 other additional chemicals put in by your local authorities. You know, you just, it's incredible what they're junking into there. So whatever you're doing is better than what you were had before, I guess. Yeah. Do you have an afternoon cup of tea? We said about land culture applies to the sea, but there's one area which probably we didn't touch in either, and that is the modification of natural systems. In Hawaii, for instance, the old Ohana system of land ownership ran right out to the reef, so the Hawaiians were great cultivators. So the only thing you can do, they farmed from the mountains right down to the coastal plains and then into the lagoon, out to the reef, and after that the reef drops off. But this is all part of the farm. So the Hawaiians built these around Molokai. The whole island has got these, you'll see a lot of Polynesian islands with coral block lagoons at the exits of all the streams, and this is the last land system where they reared their mullets. So any nutrient that escaped from the taro patches and the coconut groves and the villages was eventually converted very quickly in the sea to mullet, and the production on Molokai was 90 million pounds of first-class mullet. Well, that was more than the whole modern fishery of modern Hawaii. So when the missionaries got there, the Cooks and the Doles and all those guys, they ran cattle up here, wiped all this out, and then that filled all these up with silt. So you've got, mainly they're not functioning, but they're reviving a few of them now. And they really reduced the production of, the total production. I mean, in the old Hawaiian system, this was always forest and it was tambu. In fact, you couldn't even walk in it. So that was the source of your clean water and a lot of your mulch and fuels. This then would be taro beds down the valleys, and then there'd be coconut, and the village would be up here somewhere, and then your fish pond, and then your reef, again, was well defined. And out here in this system, they would build underwater crayfish shelters and sometimes log shelters made out of palm logs, and have little kennels, and they roof them, and they're only in the water a matter of weeks when the corals cements them all together. And I've built those too in the Seychelles, and suddenly you've got a whole population of spiny crayfish go to live in these kennels. And so you can, this is a modification of nature out here more than fish culture, because on the sandy floor of the lagoons there's no shelter. So you can build all these little shelters and animals forage in and out of them, octopus and crayfish both. So we didn't deal much with the modification of natural systems. The same when you get out on the reef, you can build all sorts of coral block shelters for fish and crayfish that are resident on the reef. So that was a nice little system. And your tribal group had to the ridge lines around these volcanic islands. You owned to the ridges. And that whole system and the people was called an Ohana. And even today, every Hawaiian knows to which Ohana they belong, although they no longer may have access to it, of course. And it was a very logical use of landscape. So it was highly integrated landscape use. There's a tree grows up here called the kukui, which is always used for mulch. And the way they start the mulch systems in the top ponds, There's your taro pond. And there's your next one. And you stuck the logs of the kikui in the pond, stood them up, and they rapidly rotted in this warm water and produced a fungus called heiheau, or ear fungus. And 85% of your log turned into edible fungus, and the rest was just squashed down as a mulch in your pond. So it was a highly integrated system from forest out to the reef. When you think about it, everything was used in a step, in a sequential way all the way down. Very sustainable. Why it's sustainable is the Hawaiians made dreadful mistakes in ecology 800 years ago, cleared all the forests, and there was huge famines. And so they started again and set up a very carefully thought out sustainable system which combines key line and permaculture, whatever else you'd like to think about. And then that all became religious. So there were very strict laws about what you could take and what you could move and all that, because they'd been through their famine about 800 years ago. Same with the Maori. They burned so much forest, they went into a famine period too. It's not that they're naturally good ecologists, it's just that after you've hit the wall, those of you who survive, who've been saying, don't cut down all the forests, well, those of you who survive suddenly become the planners, if you survive, and then you make it very strict that you can't hit that particular wall again. So I would see here a real example of aquaculture as being interposed between a stable system which provides it with basic nutrient, and also the way they mop it up before they let no nutrient really escapes in the sea before the mullet have been taken out in there. Also what grows in there, those big spotted cowries, those big tiger cowries, they're all grown in there. And a lot of their, they call it limu, seaweeds, are grown in those lagoons. So all that uptake, just before you let any of the land nutrient go, it's all taken up there. Lagoons are sparkling, clean waters. Well, whereas these are sometimes very muddy and flooded waters. So the difference between sea and land systems is not great in the way you manage them and the principles you apply, the species mixture you try and manage. And the big difference is that in the sea we grow seaweeds, and there's no real equivalent on land, except perhaps for spirulina, and that tastes like duck manure, so it's not a very big production on land, algae. But in the sea there's a whole lot of algae grown, and it depends on the sort of base on which the thing attaches. Like, a lot of them are grown on stakes or grills, some of them are grown on ropes, and some of them are grown on rock fields. For instance, all the old Irish algae farms called fields are simply large boulders they've floated out and put in lines on the seafloor, and they're very ancient. And each person knows their field under the sea, and they gather them and float all the stuff in on the tide. They're still running quite well. So it's algal culture and net culture, although net culture also comes ashore too. Otherwise, for mariculture, all the things we've been saying really apply. For aquaculture, it really is just aquaculture applied to sea systems. Anything about mariculture that you particularly want to know or grabs you? The only real difference is the substrate growing of algae. Now, all of those are fairly specialised. And it's best to go and find out from people who are growing them how to do it. Japanese grow a lot, the Hawaiians grow a few. We've got a lot of algae from here south that are quite edible, easily wild gathered, can be grown. We don't even use them, let alone grow them.
Yeah, that's right.
We eat about 9 9 to 16 species down home, depending on the season. But there's so many of them that nobody uses them at present. It's just a matter of time, I suppose, before somebody discovers them. Well, all your seaweed comes from Japan, yeah. Well, it's very cheap down home if you go and live in Stanley, Tasmania. If you can stand the climate, the seaweed's free, right? Yeah, no, it isn't. No. It's better to live, eat algae here and have it gathered down there. Yeah. One of the important algae is the purple larva, The nori is probably one of the most frequently cultivated, and that's a rope culture. You breed the nori, or the spores come out in ponds, and you just put the ropes in and tow your ropes away and grow them in the sea.
How do you actually start to do it when you say you've got a bit of rope and you want to grow some seaweed? How do you start it?
Right, first of all, you've got to breed your seaweed. So you've got to hold that in conditions of salinity and temperature, which induces it to release its gametes, you see, and then that settles on the rope, then you're off. So you've got to go there and find out how to do it. And there's whole bloody papers on it. Same with oysters, depends which oyster. Gives you the precise temperature, depth, amount of exposure to air that you need to consistently bring your oysters into breeding condition. And that depends on whether you're dealing with Japanese oysters, mud oysters, whatever oyster you're dealing with. These tolerances are well known and well documented, and breeding systems are well documented. When it comes to Murray cod, you've got to throw a big hollow drum into the water because it likes to go into a big cave. So you use an empty tank and you breed Murray cod. It's not there, they won't breed. And then you've got to artificially flood your pond. So they think the water levels, it's a flood. And then they breed. Otherwise, you've got to do it with hormones by injecting the cod. And to do that, you've got to sex them. And to sex them, you've got to knock them out. I've spent ages doing all this stuff. You've got to knock them out with chloral hydrate. You've got this gigantic, comatose Murray cod. This bloody great thing, you flopped out. And you've got to open it up to find out what sex it is. And you open it up, have a look, type it, then you sew the cod up, and you fin clip it to say it's a male or a female. And then you inject the females with pituitary extract and they come into breeding and away you go. Up to that point, we still can't tell a cod whether it's male or female by looking at the cod. So it's a... If you've got to do it all artificially, we've got to figure around, get the pituitaries out of sheep we were using, the quad satisfactory. We just crude extract. We just simply blended sheep pituitaries. Yeah, I was at the foundation of the first artificial breeding and sexing of our fish at Knobs Creek Hatchery in Victoria when I was actually working for Tasmanian Fisheries Commission at the time. But that's all routine stuff now. All you do is order your little Murray cod from Snobs Creek Hatchery. That's the easy way out for you guys, because they demand breeding, so they do it all by stimulating breeding. Or you can use natural breeding by flooding water and providing breeding holes. And a lot of Australians are doing that, successfully breeding Murray cod by just flooding their ponds. In what?
Yes.
Oh, to flood a pond, 2 or 3 feet. As long as, 2 or 3 feet is plenty.
Greater than what?
Yeah, that's right. As long as there's a distinct and sustained rise in water level, at a certain temperature, that is, the temperature's got to be high too, and it's got to be muddy, and they've got to have big hollow logs, and then they come into natural breeding. So the first guy that bred a natural muddy cod, his water tank blew away and landed in his dam. And he found himself with thousands of small cod after 6 years without any success. So he found that the eggs were in the water tanks. So then he threw water tanks in all his dams and away he went. Yeah. So a lot of it's happen chance, really. Still, for any particular fish that you select, you've got to study that fish and what is known about the fish, and you've got to go to biological abstracts and pull it all out, you know. You can't say I'm going to breed Malayan prawns and not read all the literature, because there's a lot of information on each species of fish that's grown. Yeah. Right, now... Bulk. There was a dear old guy who wrote a beaut book. He used to live in Madagascar. He's one of the fine old British homosexuals, you know, of the empire. And he was a friend of mine, actually. He used to come down to Tasmania and visit us quite a lot in fisheries, when we were in fisheries. And he wrote a beaut book while he was in Madagascar, whose name I've forgotten. Anyhow, so he was the first tilapia breeder, and he worked in Malaya under FAO. And it was he who gathered up all the species and found the sterile hybrids and all this bit. I'll think of his name in a minute. And he put it, all the foundation work in, and that was only in the 50s. You know, there were no tilapia breeding, and there was no sterile hybrid breeding or one-sex breeding before that. And he worked out all the crosses between Mozambique Eye and all the rest of them. Mozambique. Gerald Prowse. Prowse. P-R-O-W-S-E. Yeah. Yeah, Prowse is your foundation reference for tilapia. But there's a lot we haven't done with tilapia. That is, there are hundreds of tilapia that we've never... hundreds of species in Africa that we've never really bothered with. Yes, there is, yeah. Like, Prowse and other subsequent publications. There's a lot on tilapia. It's one of the best studied fish. That and the carp, I guess.
And
carp, you have special ponds. They breed on grass. And you build special little breeding ponds. You can build them. They've all got their names too. I don't know that... You keep your breeding pair in here, and then you just flood the pond up over this grass, which all these pairs come out of the breeding ponds and spawn all on the canals.
That's not land grass, is it?
Hmm?
It's not a sea grass, it's a land grass?
No, just grass. Plain old grass, yeah. Same way if you wanted to breed our native galaxians, you have to do it like that. You have to put them in a pond and flood some grass, and then they throw themselves out and lay on the rising water up on the grass so the water continues to rise over the eggs. So you've got to know your fish. And then some tilapia make little mud nests like the volcanoes. So you've got to put a section of pliable mud in the breeding ponds. And some make burrows in the side, all tilapias. And some mouth breed, and on and on and on it goes, you know. So you've just got to know your fish to know how to breed your fish. Now that's real specialist. If you want to be a real specialist, you turn into a fish breeder and supply. You're always safe in that position. The best position is to breed prawns and sell the prawn fry to other farmers, because you don't care what happens to the prawn prices or how the farmers go, whether it floods or not. You just get a constant price for your fry. Same, the best position in any fish system is to provide the basic stock. Not the gold miner who makes the money, it's the shopkeeper, you know. So we'll shop or sell prawns. But that takes you away from the pleasure of the ponds, which is really a nice environment. I used to fish for years and years. I was a professional fisherman, and I used to come up the river with a boatload of fish and sell them at 10 cents each to Greeks, who would then fry them up and get sort of $2 each. And I thought, well, hell, I'd rather be out here in the boat than standing by a frying pan all day. You know, it's worth that 90 cents. It's worth not earning that money to have your life, you know. Right. Well, I used to make plenty of money as well. Right, so all the... all these things are well documented. What you've got to do is read in your species then. So I don't know what species you'll be growing. When you make your decisions, then read in the species. You've got to read in eels and read in prawns and visit prawn farms like our friend here. Where is he?
Gone.
But he's going to grow prawns, so he's been all over Hawaii and looked at all the prawn farmers and, you know, and got all everything he can get. And now he's ready to go to grow prawns.
Where's he going to do it?
West Australia. So he's going to grow paneered prawns, which are saltwater prawns. Probably a local paneer, a banana prawn or a tiger prawn or one of those guys. Didn't he tell you about cutting one eye off?
Right. Oh, yeah.
Well, with all prawns. A lot of the growth hormones are in the eye stalks. You've got to depend on which eye. Like, life all has a timer, like you got them too, and they time away and tell you when to stop growing. And then they cut off the stop. When you cut off a prawn's eye, you cut off the thing that says stop growing. So the bloody prawn keeps on growing, you know.
Which eye is it?
Well, I don't know. Which prawn are you talking about? No, I don't know. He could tell you which eye for which prawn. You don't want to depend on it's the same eye and another prawn. Yeah.